his plan all along, to ensnare such a host? Was he not Al-Mumit, the Deathbringer? Was this not in accordance with the will of Al-Muntakim, the Retaliator? Still, Burkich worried. 100 battles had taught him that some plans never come to pass because of the changing fortunes of men, weather or circumstance. If there were already 50,000 Orthodox in place, why be greedy? Why not launch now? Burkich entered the launch area where Captain Walib was sitting in the cab of the BM-21, checking and rechecking his electronics. "Brother, a question," Burkich asked. Walib glanced up from his tablet. "Sir? Tell me again of your rockets. How accurate will they be?" "We have the exact GLONASS coordinates of both the launch vehicle and the target. The targeting computer is functioning as designed, and has acquired the coordinates. But it is the laser targeting provided by the drone that will easily put our strike within 1 meter of our intended target. Our kill box, the stadium, is approximately 300 meters by 300 meters. We can't possibly miss. And if we launched right now, with 50,000 on site already, what casualties do you anticipate?" "Open air. No place to hide. Perfect weather." It was a simple math problem. 9 to 12,000 dead. 12 to 15,000 wounded, many of whom will die of complications later. Many survivors will suffer permanent injuries. Blindness, loss of hearing, loss of limbs, respiratory defects. It would be a decisive blow. And if that number should rise to 70,000? Walib shrugged. 12 to 18,000 dead, 20 to 24,000 wounded. And I am being conservative. Burkich paced in front of Walib, stroking his beard, calculating. His organization, Al-Qaeda in the Balkans, or AQAB, would broadcast live video of the launch and blast social media with it, along with footage of the carnage afterward, mocking the Orthodox Serb heathen and their impotent Russian puppet masters. The worse the carnage, the more the Russians would be provoked. And the more provoked, the more likely to intervene. And with the forces of the Slavic sword and shield exercises just across the border, they had the means to do so. 9,000 dead would surely be enough to provoke them. But if he waited a few more minutes, it was possible that as many as 18,000 would perish. But then again, planners like Walib always assumed the best-case scenario. What if there were misfires, or a sudden gust of wind? If his casualty numbers were off by half, two-thirds? Yes, better to wait. Especially if there were contingencies, Burkich decided. The more slaughter, the more likely the Russians were to intervene, and NATO to respond. The blood of the Orthodox would fuel the hellish fire that would be the next world war, and save the Ummah from their suffering in Muslim lands at the hands of the Kafar. This would lead to the uprising of all brothers across Europe, and the final conquest of the world under the banner of Islam. All he needed was a little patience, a little faith. Allahu Akbar. Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Jack packed and scrambled out of the apartment, reminding himself to send his landlords a text when he got to the airport, apologizing for not cleaning up and for the broken pictures and asking them to bill his credit card for damages. He'd call Kolak after he arrived in the States and let him know about trash pickup. Bosnia and the United States had no extradition treaty, though Jack could reasonably claim self-defense if it came to that. This time he was smart enough to grab a retinal scan of his intended killer, along with the man's fingerprints from apps on his iPhone. He also took the man's wallet with credit cards and ID, as well as his cell phone, so that he could get those to Gavin for further analysis. He also grabbed the man's car keys. Why pay for a cab if he didn't have to? Down on the street, he hit the key fob and a green Skoda sedan beeped. Jack opened the trunk to toss in his suitcase. and spotted a gun bag. He zipped it open and found a Heckler & Koch MP7 machine pistol with iron sights. A sweet rig, firing a 4.6 by 30 millimeter round. The MP7 was one of Jack's favorite weapons to shoot. He zipped the bag back up and tossed a blanket over it, hoping like hell the Bosnian police had no reason to pull him over and do a trunk check. If they did, it would be a guaranteed one-way ticket to the local hoosgow. But getting pulled over was unlikely on a day like today, when all of the cops would be tied up with the renewal service at the soccer stadium, and the idea of having his own wheels appealed to him. He tossed his suitcase and laptop on top of the blanket, jumped in the car, and plugged the airport address into the dashboard GPS. Fortunately, he was driving against traffic, so the road was relatively clear in his direction. The traffic flooding into town was clogged with vehicles flying all manner of flags and banners, variations of double-headed Serbian eagles and Orthodox crosses, and sometimes both, much the same way American Christians melded church and nationalism together. What really caught Jack's attention was a flapping red and gold banner and the scowling Orthodox Jesus, his eyes dark and disapproving. 30 minutes later, Jack pulled into the short-term parking lot and found a spot on the far end. He killed the engine and grabbed his bags out of the trunk. He locked it and pocketed the keys, figuring he'd toss them into the trash inside the lobby. He made a beeline for the glass doors of the small terminal. The familiar smell of jet fuel in the air and the sound of a turboprop revving on the taxiway suddenly putting him in a traveling mood. There was still enough time to make his 8:42 a.m. flight, but just barely. Before he crossed the parking lot, his cell phone rang with Jerry's distinctive ringtone. Jack was glad to get the call. He was finally at the airport, and that would make his boss happy. The Gulfstream 550 was making its approach to the Sarajevo International Airport, following the entry point and radar vector instructions from the air traffic controller. The pilot dropped speed and altitude toward runway 12, the only arrival runway at the small but efficient facility. They were still 5,000 feet in the air, but descending quickly through the clear September sky.
"Man, looks like the 110 freeway before a Dodgers game," Midas said, staring out of the window. "I'd hate to be driving around down there today. What's going on?"
The Eastern Orthodox Church is holding some kind of big outdoor religious service in a few hours, according to the local news reports, Adara said, powering down her laptop for landing. Orthodox Christians from all over the region are showing up for it, including a bunch of politicians.
"Good thing we're just picking Jack up at the FBO hangar then," Dom said. "No worries."
"And then home," Midas said. "I'm tired of this snipe hunt." Emir pressed the SA-25 Werba Willow man pads against his narrow shoulder with his gloved hands, his eye fixed to the sight. The Werba automatically acquired and tracked the low-altitude civilian jet, feeding target data to the onboard computer controlling the missile's multispectrum optical seeker. Even if the small civilian aircraft carried anti-missile defenses such as flares, decoys, or laser systems like Sky Shield, the Werba's advanced seeker could discriminate between them and the actual target. The latest Russian anti-aircraft missile could take out high-flying supersonic NATO warplanes and cruise missiles, making it the most feared portable manpads in the Russian arsenal. A low-speed, low-altitude civilian airplane like the one he was tracking was no match against it. The Werba was just one of the many stolen gifts bestowed upon Akub by the Syrian captain and his Chechen lieutenant, Jabrailov. He pulled the trigger. The solid-fuel 9M336 missile roared out of its tube, launching the high-explosive 1.5-kilogram warhead at supersonic speed toward the hapless civilian jet. The missile trailed a long finger of white exhaust as it clawed its way into the air. Within seconds, the warhead slammed into the aircraft's thin aluminum skin in a thundering explosion, shattering the fuselage in a fiery cloud of twisted metal. Chapter 58. Jack whipped around at the sound of the booming explosion of the Werba missile 1,800 feet above. Its arcing smoke trail pointed to its launch origin west of the airfield, a mile away, maybe more. The plane's burning wreckage plunged toward the earth, leaving a trail of smashed luggage and cabin debris fluttering in its wake. "Dear God," Jack whispered, his eyes widening. Broken bodies were tumbling through the sky, some still strapped to their seats. One of those bodies should have been his. He fought back a wave of nausea. It suddenly occurred to him that Jerry's ass-chewing phone call in the parking lot earlier had just saved his life. Jerry had instructed him to forget his whaling flight and instead make his way over to the fixed base operator hangar, where arrangements had already been made for the Hendley Associates Gulfstream to land and pick him up. Jerry warned Jack that Midas and Dom were instructed to put him on the Gulfstream by any means necessary. Jack had left the main terminal and come over to this private hangar to wait. The Gulfstream was still 10 minutes out. Then it suddenly hit him. He was supposed to be on that whaling flight, but he'd purchased a ticket for Aida, too. Maybe that missile was meant for her? Jack grabbed his phone and punched in her number, but his phone rang with Dom's number. "Jack, it's me. What the hell just happened down there? Somebody took out a passenger jet. The one I was supposed to be on." "You must be in some kind of shit, all right, cuz. Look, the air traffic controller just put us on hold. They're not allowing any flights in or out until they can assess the situation on the ground. We've got enough fuel to loiter for another 40 minutes, but if it gets beyond that, we'll have to land somewhere else and then come get you by car." "Dude, I gotta go." "Hold on, Jack. The whole point of us coming to get you was to get your ass out of the fire. Don't you go running back into it or Jerry'll have my hide. Why did he send you all the way over here to pick me up anyway?" Jack glanced at the burning black cloud mushrooming in the distance. "He didn't send us just to pick you up. We're over in this neck of the woods chasing leads on this outfit called the Iron Syndicate." "Yeah, Jerry mentioned it. Something to do with that crazy woman in Slovenia that tried to kill me. One and the same. Maybe they're the ones that fired that missile." "Don't think so. They've got a thing about collecting my head. Unless they changed their thing. I gotta go." "Stay put, Jack. We'll be there in a few. Can't wait. Track my phone if you want to find me." Jack killed the call and dialed Aida again. The phone rang until it went to voicemail. "Aida, it's me, Jack. Call me back as soon as you get this. I need to know you're okay." He hung up. Jack wasn't clear in his own mind who had done it. Serb nationalists? The Mafia? The Russians? Maybe even Kolak? Shit, Jack thought. It was like the fucking Star Wars cantina around here. They all had it in for her. Jack called the refugee center. Another voicemail. He hung up. Called the Happy Times tour office. Voicemail again. Jack's anxiety spiked. Shit. Now what? He could drive to the tour office or the refugee center, but traffic was miserable going back into the city. No point in trying to navigate that if he couldn't be sure she would be at either location. But her place out in the country was west of here, away from the traffic. That was his best bet. Chances were she'd turn up there eventually if she was okay. He patted the keys in his pocket, glad he hadn't tossed them into the trash yet, and ran back toward the parking lot, praying the Škoda hadn't been towed. The Škoda hadn't been towed, fortunately, and Jack sped out of the lot as fast as he could without breaking the law, grateful for the Bosnian marks he still had in his pocket to pay the ticket to leave. Jack hit the main road heading west, driving the speed limit. He didn't want to get pulled over for any reason, let alone the MP7 that was now stashed underneath his seat, locked and loaded. He found an English language news station on the radio. It was already reporting the jet crash. "Authorities believe the whaling Embraer E-170 aircraft was destroyed with a shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missile. As many as 66 passengers may have been on the flight, though the number has not yet been confirmed. No survivors are expected. The Serbian National Front for the Liberation of Bosnia and Herzegovina has claimed credit for the attack on social media sites." "Sons of bitches," Jack said out loud, his anger boiling over at the Serb nationalists who could murder innocent people like that. but in his head he heard Kolak's three narratives lecture again. Three sides to every fact. There had been a lot of local attacks by all sides lately, and all of them escalating. It was hard to tell the good guys from the bad guys. Jack wondered if the Serbian National Front really was behind the attack, or if the SNF even existed. He drove along in silence for a while, listening to the story repeat every few minutes. Nothing new to report, except for denials by Serb politicians and activists, claiming it was a false flag attack by either Croats or Muslims, meant to distract from the Orthodox Renewal Service later that day. Were they telling the truth? Or covering their tracks? Who knew in this crazy place? Jack followed the little blue arrow on the dashboard GPS. Part of his PERSEC training early on with the campus was to always memorize new locations, as he'd done when Aida drove him to her place yesterday. He thought he could have found it on his own, but the GPS was too handy to ignore on the winding mountain road. He prayed to God that she was there, and that she was safe. Chapter 59. 25 minutes later, Jack made the turn off the asphalt and followed the hard-packed dirt road toward Aida's compound behind the trees. He saw the top of the two-story chalet peeking above the pines, and his pulse raced. Last night with her had seared itself deep in his soul. When Jack's Škoda cleared the trees and entered the compound, he saw two vehicles, a black Renault coupe and Aida's Happy Times Volkswagen T5 tour van. Two bearded Bosniaks were loading heavy canvas duffels into the van. They glanced up when they saw Jack, their eyes flashing with concern. They exchanged a look, dropped their duffels in the dirt, and reached behind them. Jack knew that move all too well. He slammed the brakes, shoved the shifter into reverse, and crushed the throttle. The Škoda leaped backward at the first crack of pistol rounds. Bullets spanged against the front grille and spiderwebbed the windshield as Jack navigated through the rear window, steering with one hand. Suddenly the rear window exploded into tiny glass nuggets, some of them hitting Jack in the face. Instinctively, his driving arm jerked and the Škoda swerved hard off the road and slammed into a tree. Bam! Front and side airbags exploded open as Jack was jerked hard and forward by the crash, slamming his face into one. He was slathered in talcum powder from the bag storage and blinded by the big balloons of air. As he reached for his seatbelt release, the passenger bag burst with a pop, punctured by a 9mm round. Jack grabbed the MP7 and rolled out of the driver's side door, using it as a shield against the slugs thudding into the steel panel. Jack dove and rolled for the nearest tree, racked the charging handle, then stood and took aim through the iron sights at the first man racing toward him. He unleashed a short burst, opening the man's chest like a reciprocating saw. The dual force of the speeding projectiles smashed into the Bosniak's upper torso like steel fists, clotheslining him. His feet kicked out from under him as his back slammed to the ground. In the two eye blinks it took to dispatch him, the other Bosniak had cleared the far side of the Škoda and taken aim at Jack. He got off three rounds from his pistol, splintering the bark near Jack's face, before Jack unleashed leaded fury, tearing open the man's throat and walking rounds up into his mouth in a spray of teeth and blood until the magazine emptied. The man was dead by the time he tumbled into the dirt. Jack checked for more tangos, but none were visible. He popped open the trunk and fished around for another mag, but he couldn't find one. He tossed the useless rifle back into the trunk and slammed it shut. His heart was racing, but not because he was afraid. He had to find Aida. Now. Jack dashed past the ruined Škoda, keeping as close to the trees as possible for cover. He stopped at the clearing and knelt down, scanning the compound from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock, looking for more shooters. But there were none. There was no movement in the chalet windows either, and the front door was open, just as the dead shooters had left it. The Volkswagen van hadn't moved, and no one was in it. Same with the Renault coupe. The two heavy green canvas duffels lay in the dirt where the Bosniaks had dropped them. He knelt down to open one, when he heard a woman scream. "Jack!" The terrified scream came from inside, and it was Aida's voice. Jack bolted for the porch, slamming his back against the wall. Aida! No answer. No gun. No knife. Nothing but his fists. If there was anyone else inside with a gun, he didn't stand a chance. He didn't care. Jack dashed inside, sweeping his eyes left, then right. Nobody. Just the heavy dining table where he and Aida had eaten dinner last night, an open laptop on top. He listened. Nothing. No. Wait. Sobbing. Jack ran for Aida's bedroom, kicking the door open. She lay on the bed, fetal, wrapped in a blanket. Aida! He rushed to the bed, knelt down next to her, still sobbing. Are you hurt? He rolled her over carefully. Aida's sobs slowed. Her face was covered in her thick hair. Oh, Jack. He leaned over her, gently pushing her hair aside. Aida. Her face broke into an aching smile. And then a laugh. Oh, Jack. My beautiful idiot. She jammed a Makarov pistol beneath his jaw, her wide blue eyes bright with mischief. A pistol racked behind his head. She laughed again. You are so fucked. Yeah. He was. Idiot. Jack was duct-taped to one of the low-backed wooden chairs from the dining table, from the middle of his shoulders to his elbows. Even his wrists were taped together, his palms touching as if in prayer, and his forearms lay helpless in his lap. Aida sat at the table, tapping keys on the laptop next to a burner phone. No wonder she never picked up her smartphone, Jack thought. Emir carried a wooden crate, a chromed Colt 1911 45 shoved into his waistband. Last one. He nodded toward Jack. And then we can go. By which he means time for me to die. He hardly cared. He was raging and ashamed, all at the same time. She'd played him big time. How could he not have seen it coming? Because I'd been a damned idiot, that's how. Thinking with my head instead of my brain. I'll be ready, Aida said, as Emir stepped into the harsh morning light. Aida stood and turned the laptop around so that Jack could see it. Do you know what you're looking at? Jack leaned forward as far as the duct tape would allow, squinting his eyes. I don't know. The Depeche Mode concert? It's a live video feed from our drone, flying high over the Olympic soccer stadium, hosting the Orthodox renewal. All of those people down there are crowding in like sardines in order to receive the blessings of their priests. Well, we have another blessing in store for them. She checked her watch. In exactly 42 minutes, they're all going to die. Just like those innocent people killed on that plane. Oh no, these Serbs will suffer much, much more than they did. Why are you doing this? I tried to explain it to you, Jack. But you're too American to understand. She pocketed her burner phone. I can't believe you killed those people. She giggled coyly. Me? I didn't. Emir is the one who pulled the trigger. But you ordered him to, didn't you?
Yes.
To kill me.
I had to. You became a loose end.
And that's supposed to make me feel better?
Well, I shouldn't think so. Especially since you're responsible for all of them dying.
Kill him now and let's go, Emir said, stepping back into the room. The commander is waiting for us. You mean Birkic, don't you? Jack asked. Whack! Emir backhanded Jack.
Shut your mouth. You are not worthy to speak his name.
Emir pulled his chromed pistol out of his waistband and pointed it at Jack. Aida laid her hand on the barrel and pushed it down.
Not yet.
What are you waiting for? Kill him now! He treated you like his whore. He raised his gun back up. Not yet. I want him to see history unfold before his eyes, and to know the part he played in starting World War III. And then he can die. Emir smiled at the thought.
Sure. Why not?
Good. You stay here with him. I'm going to the site. When it's done, blow his brains out, then come. She kissed Emir on the forehead and headed for the door. The small Bosniak was visibly shaken by the kiss, as if 1,000 volts of electricity had been shot through his body. His resolve stiffened. Aida stopped and turned, a dark shadow framed in the doorway, the blazing sun behind her. You Americans sicken me. Ignorant, arrogant, naive. You are all fools. But you, Jack Ryan, are the biggest fool of all. She laughed as she headed for her van. Emir brayed like a mule. The Volkswagen's engine fired up outside, spitting gravel as it sped away. Chapter 60. Emir pulled up a chair and sat in it, still a safe distance away from Jack's long reach, even though he couldn't do much reaching at the moment. Jack glanced at the laptop. A countdown clock was running. 40 minutes remaining. What the hell am I going to do? You know she played you too, right? Emir frowned. What are you talking about? You're never going to see her again. Emir sneered as he shook his head. You don't know anything, do you? I know she's a lying bitch. Watch your mouth, Ryan. And if I don't, soon you won't be saying anything to anybody. And you're okay with this? Mass murder? Murder? They are infidels who have butchered my people for centuries. They slaughtered my family in the last war. Therefore, this is not murder. It is holy justice. I thought you belonged to the religion of peace. Emir nodded. When all men are Muslims, there will be peace. But until then, his back stiffened, there will be jihad. Except you guys kill more of each other than we do. Emir spat on the floor. The days of the filthy Shia are numbered. Until you clowns can figure out how to invent something useful, like an internal combustion engine or a telephone, I wouldn't sweat trying to run the planet. Emir wasn't biting. Pathetic. Time to step it up. Jack turned his attention back toward the laptop. Another 40 minutes of this? Don't you have Netflix or something? Always with the jokes, you Americans. But this is no joke. This is how the world you know ends, in fire and blood. That's stupid. There isn't going to be a World War III. It is the truth. How? A bunch of Serbs get killed. So what? Who cares? That's like a bunch of dead ragheads. Whack! Emir backhanded Jack again. Just like Jack hoped he would. Watch your mouth, Ryan, or you'll watch that screen without any teeth in your ugly head. Jack shook off the sting. Enlighten me, shit for brains. Emir stood over Jack. You Americans don't know history. You don't know anything, except your filthy rap music and pornography. Don't knock 'em if you haven't tried 'em. Jack shifted beneath the stranglehold of duct tape. Emir raised his hand to strike again, and Jack shut his eyes, wincing, preparing for the blow. Emir stayed his hand and laughed. Not so tough now, huh? Take off this tape and I'll show you. Emir's eyes flared with hatred. He turned his back to watch the screen. Being ignored wasn't part of Jack's plan. He tried another tack. Okay, so enlighten me. How does killing Serbs start World War III? Emir turned back around. Commander Burkic has thought of everything. We will claim responsibility for this strike. The Russians will invade, and NATO will fight Russia. What kind of strike? A bomb? Chemicals? Biologics? None of your business. Just watch and pray. Don't tell me to pray, you satanic little fuck. Whack! Jack didn't wince that time, despite the welt forming beneath his beard. Shit, dude, that almost hurt. You hit like my little sister, only not as hard. Whack! Come on, you little goat fucker. That's the best you got? Jack roared with laughter. No wonder you could never close the deal with Aida. He shook his head, grinning.
Man, that girl sure liked to shut up. Amir drew his big semi-auto Colt and pointed it at Jack. Time to die. Oh, no, 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 little fella. Aida said you had to wait until after the big show before you pulled that trigger. Pray to Allah he will accept you into his paradise, infidel. Amir racked the slide. The heavy 45 caliber bullet already in the chamber ejected, bouncing on the floorboards. You dropped one, Chief. No worries, Jack. Plenty more where that came from. I don't think a pissant like you can kill a man like me face to face. You're about to find out. Amir flicked off the safety. Sure, fire a rocket launcher, kill a bunch of strangers up in the sky. But up close and personal, eye to eye, you don't have the balls. Amir stepped closer, staring hard into Jack's eyes. Just watch. See? You're afraid to get close. I mean, real close. I'm not stupid. Are you sure? How would you know if you were? Amir glanced behind Jack's back, checking his restraints. Then he stepped around behind the chair, keeping the gun pointed at Jack's head. He pulled at the duct tape and shook it hard to make sure Jack was still secured. He was. See, dipshit? I'm not dangerous. I'm tied up like a sacrificial lamb. But this little lamb's got way bigger balls than you. Just ask Aida. Whack! Amir smacked Jack's skull with the barrel of the pistol. Lights flashed in Jack's eyes, like he'd been hit in the head with a steel brick, which he had. Jack shook it off with a laugh. Fuck you, douchebag. Get it over with. Amir stepped up and shoved the pistol in Jack's face, an inch from his nose. Jack stared straight up the barrel, from the bladed front sight back through the square notch on the rear sight, all the way to Amir's raging eyes. The barrel trembled. Put it against my forehead, you little shit. Put it hard against my skull if you have the guts. Then pull the trigger. But I bet you can't. You're too weak. Amir jammed the barrel against Jack's forehead. Jack felt the barrel's cold, smooth crown pressing into his skin. He pushed back harder. Amir's arms stiffened. Jack's eyes bored into Amir's, his bearded face twisted into a smug, satisfied grin. That's better, Jack said. You want that barrel nice and tight against my skull so the gun doesn't flip back and crack you in the face when it fires. Amir's grin faded. Something was wrong. What was the American up to? Jack shoved his head forward, grabbing Amir's attention. What the fuck are you waiting for, pussy? Your period? Rage flashed over Amir's face, but then it faded, giving way to a slow, wide grin. His fingers squeezed the trigger. Nothing. Frowning with confusion, Amir pulled the gun back to check it, racking in another round and oomph! Jack launched his boot into the Bosniak's ball sack, crushing his testicles with the devastating kick. Amir dropped the gun, bent over and grabbed his crotch. Jack lunged up in a half-squat as Amir bent over, driving his frontal dome, the hardest part of his skull, straight into Amir's nose, breaking it with a sickening crack and a gusher of blood. Standing in a half-crouch and still tied to the chair, Jack turned sideways and threw his entire body weight against the much smaller man. Amir lost his footing and stumbled to the floor. Jack turned and kicked the pistol, sending it skittering across the rough-hewn boards, then turned back around and kicked as hard as he could at Amir's head. The toe of his boot struck home with a nauseating crunch. Amir howled with pain as he clutched his face, balling himself up to prevent another boot strike to his skull. Just what Jack wanted. Jack raised his size 14 foot as high as he could and stomped the side of Amir's head, driving it into the floor. He stomped again, and again, and again. Amir flailed widely, kicking at Jack but missing, blinded by pain and his own gushing blood slicking the wooden floor like an oil spill. Amir tucked one arm under his head to cushion it against the floor and the other on top to protect his ear, now partially torn off from the repeated boot strikes. So Jack kicked him in the face again.
kicked him so hard that Emir's head snapped back, collapsing the fragile anterior nasal spine just below his nose and smashing his brain hard against his skull, knocking him out. Jack raised his foot one more time to deliver a killing blow to Emir's exposed neck. But he hesitated. He couldn't kill a helpless, unconscious man, no matter how miserable a human being he was. Chances were he was going to die anyway. Emir was God's problem now. Jack lowered his foot. He stood in his tortured half-crouch over the bleeding figure, gasping for air, the duct tape still tying him to the chair like a crooked crucifix, but he hardly felt it for the adrenaline dump still surging through his blood. Jack couldn't believe his luck. Shoving the barrel of the Colt against his skull had pushed the slide back just enough to engage the disconnector, putting the gun out of battery and preventing it from firing. It was a long shot, but the only one he could think of at the time to get out of this jam. Now, he had another problem. How the hell was he going to get out of this damn chair? Chapter 61. Jack turned around and scanned the kitchen. On the counter was a knife block, but he couldn't stand up tall enough to reach any of the knife handles. He thought about swinging the chair legs up high enough to sweep the knife block off the counter, but chances were he'd only bang into the cabinets. He didn't see any other sharp surfaces he could use to cut the duct tape with either. But then he remembered. He really didn't need any. Jack sat back down in his chair and steadied himself. He took a deep breath, leaned back as far as he could within the constraints of the duct tape. Then Jack knifed his upper torso down toward his knees as sharply as he could. The duct tape split at the chair edges from the force of his thrust as neatly as if he had ripped it with his fingers. He stood and shook his body to free himself from the remaining strands of tape, toppling the chair to the floor. He then raised his bound wrists high above his head, palms together, fingertips touching. He thrust his arms down sharply, driving his elbows hard against his sides for additional leverage. The duct tape around his wrists gave way easily, though it tore away the hair on his arms and left a little bit of sticky goo on the face of his eye watch. He ripped away the remaining shreds of duct tape from his clothing before dashing over to Emir's motionless body. He felt for a pulse. He found one. Barely. He checked for more weapons, but found none, save another loaded magazine for the Colt, which he pocketed, along with a set of keys for the Renault and, most important, his own iPhone, which Emir had lifted from him previously. Jack ran over to the laptop. Nothing had changed, but the countdown timer read just 38 minutes now. He punched in Gavin Beery's number on his phone. Two rings, and Gavin picked up. "Hey, Jack, you okay? I heard about that airplane. I'm fine. Look, I need you to run a search for a Volkswagen van owned by a Bosnian tour company called Happy Times, based out of Sarajevo. It's the only Volkswagen T5 van in their fleet. You got a plate number by any chance?" "Sorry, no." "What do I do when I find it?" "It has a working GPS map guide. I need you to locate its GPS signal and track it for me." "On it, Jack. Give me a few." Keys began clicking instantly over the phone. "Thanks." Jack set his phone on the table next to the laptop and put it on speaker. He knew he didn't have any legal authority to do anything. But if Emir was telling the truth, he had to find a way to stop whatever was about to happen at that stadium, and the only way he was going to do that was to find Aida, and find her fast. Besides, she had to pay for those people she ordered murdered today. So did Brkić. He thought briefly about calling Kolak for assistance, or even the local police, but at this point he had no idea whom he could trust. Besides, all of those people died this morning because of him. It was up to him to make things right, not pass off the responsibility to someone else. He probably needed to read Jerry in on what was happening, but at this point all Jerry would do was yell at him and tell him to get his ass back to the airport. "Found it," Gavin said on the speaker. "I'm tracking it live. Can you send the track to my phone?" "Doing it now." "Thanks, buddy. Hey, one more thing. I've got a laptop I'm staring at. We need to find out what's on it and what we're up against. Send me the local IPv4 address, and I'll mirror your machine. Is it Windows 10? "Yeah, just give me a sec."
Jack found it easily and read it off to him. "Thanks, Jack. I'll take it from here." Keys started clacking on the phone speaker again. "Gav, we need to hustle. How long will it take?" "Not sure." A second later, the cursor arrow moved remotely on the laptop screen. "I'm in, Jack. What am I looking at?" A live video feed from a drone looking down at the Olympic soccer stadium in Sarajevo. "What's that countdown counter for?" "In 37 minutes, that stadium is going to be destroyed. I need you to find out exactly how." Gavin pulled up another window remotely. It displayed a video of a middle-aged man in camouflage holding a short-barreled AKS-74U and sitting in front of a black Aqab battle flag with white Arabic letters that spelled out the Shahada. The man's full, wild, red and gray beard was offset by a white cloth prayer cap, but it was his milky white eye that drew Jack's attention. "This is all in some crazy language, Jack." "Bosanski," Jack said. "Bosnian." "I'll run my AI translator. It's good at real-time audio." More windows popped up as Gavin worked. Some were documents, and others were video frames. "So how long?" Jack asked. "As long as it takes. I can't sit around here waiting." "Use your iPhone as a local hotspot. Connect it to the laptop via Bluetooth, and then I can stay connected to the machine through your phone wherever you need to go. I'll call you if I find anything." "Perfect. I'm going after that GPS locator you sent me. And Gav, don't breathe a word of this to Jerry. I'll tell him myself when we know more." "Sure thing, Jack. And good luck."
"Thanks. I'm going to need it." Chapter 62. Jack jumped into Emir's Renault. He set the open laptop on the passenger seat, then took an extra minute and synced his phone with the Renault's Bluetooth audio so that conversation with Gavin would come through the car's audio speakers. He then set his smartphone on the dash so he could more easily follow the GPS signal from Aida's Volkswagen. Jack punched the gas and headed out of the compound, Emir's Colt in his lap. Jack followed the blue GPS arrow on his phone generated by the signal coming from Aida's Volkswagen. For the most part, he was just following the two-lane E73 north and west as through the contour of the mountains. She was 10 minutes ahead of him and making good time, heading higher into the pine-covered hills. They seemed to be the only two vehicles on the road.
"Jack, I found something," Gavin's voice said over the car's audio system. "It's a video scheduled to go out to social media at 10:16 a.m. local. That's just 35 minutes from now. Some guy named Commander Berkich issued a fatwa against all non-believers and crusaders."
"Is that the guy with the blind eye?"
"Yeah. Says he launched the thermobaric missiles that killed thousands."
"Past tense, because the video hasn't gone out yet."
"Thermobarics. Holy shit.
What's the delivery system?"
"Can't be sure. But there's footage of masked fighters standing in front of a Soviet-era BM-21 Grad rocket launch system, flashing victory signs and waving a black flag. It's basically a 6x6 truck with a box launcher on back. According to Google, it holds 40 122-millimeter ballistic missiles."
"You think it's possible he has one in his arsenal?"
"The BM-21 is the most deployed missile launch system in the world, and the Bosnian army has had them since Tito's days. So, yeah, it's credible. Only thing is, something doesn't make sense."
"What doesn't?"
"The launch system isn't known for being real accurate. I did a quick check of the stadium measurements. There's a good chance a lot of those missiles won't land inside it.
But a lot of people will still get hurt."
"Still not the kind of casualties he's promising on that video. He obviously thinks his system is more accurate."
"How?"
"I haven't figured that out yet."
"Maybe he's bluffing."
"This guy doesn't look like a bluffer to me," Gavin said. "And why brag about it if it didn't or doesn't happen? Then he looks like an idiot."
"Good point. Let's assume he's telling the truth. We need to figure out how he plans to pull it off."
"Can I tell Jerry what's going on now? He's been breathing down my neck."
"He's at the office? At this hour?"
"Just arrived 10 minutes ago. He's been after me to try and reach you."
"I'll call him right now."
"Good luck with that, Jack. You're not exactly his favorite person at the moment."
"Thanks for the heads up." Jack rang off, then dialed Jerry's phone. He picked up after the first ring. "I've got a funny feeling you're not at the airport," the ex-senator growled. "Worse than that. We've got a situation." Jack read him in on the video and possible missile strike. "Good God almighty, Jack. This is a nightmare scenario. We need to start an immediate evacuation." "Bad idea. Whatever asshole is watching the video feed will see it and order an immediate launch. Besides, the city is jammed. You couldn't empty that place out if you tried." "Damn it, you're right. I'm on the way now to shut it down, if I can locate it. I don't know how you managed to step in front of this stampede, Jack, but you've got to find a way to stop it." "With only 35 minutes left until the launch, I can't promise you I'll get it done." "I'm calling Mary Pat Foley now to fill her in. Keep me posted. And for the love of God, watch your six, will you?" Chapter 63. Washington, D.C. The dreaded 3 a.m. phone call had been a talking point in nearly every presidential campaign for the past 20 years, a metaphor for the gut-wrenching, unexpected national emergencies that usually cropped up at the most inconvenient moments. The clock read 3:41 a.m. when President Ryan's cell phone rang. He picked it up from the nightstand, yawning. His wife stirred. "What's wrong?" "Nothing, hon. Go back to bed." But Dr. Kathy Ryan knew better, having received a few early morning emergency eye surgery phone calls herself over the years. Nobody called at this time of the morning for either of them, unless it was a blood-soaked catastrophe in the making. "I'll put on a pot of coffee." She dragged a comforting hand across his shoulder as she shuffled past him toward the kitchen, yawning. Ryan smiled, grateful for the amazing woman sharing his crazy life. "How bad is it, Mary Pat?" "As bad as it gets." DNI Foley filled him in on the events of the last 24 hours as relayed to her by Jerry, and the ticking clock winding down toward Armageddon with the Russians. The civilian aircraft had been blown out of the sky just a few hours before, but because no Americans were on board, the president wasn't notified, even though his son apparently had been the target. "Mr. President, if Jack can't find those rockets and take them out..." "Yeah, I know. We need to get the Russians in on this ASAP. We don't have a lot of options right now. Hell, we don't have any, since we don't even have a target at this point. Right now, it's all up to Jack." The first call President Ryan made was to his chief of staff, Arnie Van Dam. Arnie was a veteran of as many 3 a.m. phone calls as he was, because Arnie was the first person Ryan always called at a time like this. "Arnie, you've got 5 minutes to organize a conference call with Scott, Bob, and Mary Pat, and patch it over to the Situation Room." "What's this about?" "No time to explain." Ryan checked his watch. Shit, he'd already burned 4 minutes. "And now we've got just 30 minutes to go." "It'll take at least 20. "You've got 5. "On it, boss." Ryan stood in the kitchen in a pair of faded Levi's, a threadbare USMC sweatshirt, and a battered pair of Saucony running shoes, calling on the landline to the overnight White House operator. "Get me Admiral Dean, Commander, U.S. Naval Forces, Europe, Africa, head of the 6th Fleet, based in Naples, Italy. I don't care if he's on the crapper reading Marcus Aurelius, I need him on the phone now. And patch it through to my personal cell. Understood?" "Understood, sir." "And then get me General Colgan, 31st Fighter Wing in Aviano, Italy. Same drill." "Right away, sir." Two options, maybe, he thought, as Kathy handed him a sealed thermal cup of steaming black coffee and a kiss on the cheek. He bolted for the door, shoving his Bluetooth into his ear, searching his mind for more options, trying to remember distances and maps and borders in a part of the world he hadn't thought about in a long time. Some men panicked when a crisis hit, but Ryan's mind cleared and focused like a sniper's scope drawing a bead on a distant target. That ability made him a good Marine officer and a first-rate CIA analyst when he was younger, but it served him best now that he was commander-in-chief. He stood on the edge of a perfect storm of bad actors, bad intentions, and bad timing. Everything hung on his next decision. but he didn't want to make it until he heard back from his son, racing into the eye of that same perfect storm. As president, he was grateful a man like Jack was on the scene. As a father, he was scared to death. Chapter 64. The bleary-eyed communications tech working the video teleconferencing, VTC cameras, and audio in the Situation Room yawned violently behind the control room glass. Ryan thought she looked like she had just graduated from high school, but she must have been in her early 20s. She was damn good. Patching in the live video feed from Aida's laptop onto one of the big wall monitors, as well as video teleconferencing with Arnie Van Dam, DNI Foley, and SecDef Burgess, all scattered across the country. She also patched in Jack on his phone, along with Jerry and Gavin, who were at the Hendley Associates office in Alexandria, before the first tray of coffee had arrived. The countdown clock from the laptop displayed on the main monitor. Just 25 minutes until the rocket strike at the soccer stadium. President Ryan stood at the head of the long table, leaning on it, his eyes fixed on one of the wall monitors. According to Gavin's brief, our best guess is that the launch platform is a BM-21 Grad MRLS like the one playing on your screens from the Birkic video. It's mobile as hell, and we don't know where it is at the moment. That box launcher holds 40 122-millimeter thermobaric missiles, with a maximum operational range of 24 miles. Let's assume half that distance, because these jokers don't want to push their luck. That means there's over 450 miles of territory to search, much of it tree-covered mountains. How in the hell do we find it in the next 25 minutes? USA 224 isn't due over that area for another 18 minutes, Foley said. She was referring to the NRO's KH-11 keyhole orbiting optical satellite. Not that it would do much good in that terrain if they're trying to hide it. Espiers is geostationary, but that's only going to tell us when the rockets are launched. Assuming we do find it, our options for taking it out are limited, to put it mildly, Ryan said. F-16s out of Aviano would be my choice, Burgess said. Ryan shook his head. General Colgan says it will take 32 minutes before his Falcons can scramble and deliver a payload. That's 7 minutes too late if I give him the go order right now. And the nearest carrier is currently on a NATO training exercise off the coast of Portugal, so naval aviation is out of the question. But according to Admiral Dean, we have a guided missile destroyer steaming approximately 20 miles off the coast of Croatia at this very moment. Tomahawks, Mary Pat Foley said. Precisely. From the destroyer's position to Sarajevo, the Tomahawk flight time is just under 15 minutes. But we still don't have a target location, Arnie said. We'll have to get it within the next 9 minutes if we hope to prevent the attack. Ryan's eyes narrowed. There is one other option. On board the USS Garza, DDG-116, Adriatic Sea, 20 miles southwest of Dubrovnik, Croatia. The Arleigh Burke-class guided missile destroyer sat in the choppy waters of the Blue Adriatic, its launch alarm klaxon blaring like an ambulance siren, warning sailors to clear the foredeck where the 32 cells of the Vertical Launch System, VLS, were located behind the 5-inch gun. One of the cell hatches burst open in a gush of blinding orange fire as the solid-fuel rocket booster of a GM-UGM-109E, TLAM Block 4 Tomahawk cruise missile, roared from beneath the deck. When it reached its cruising altitude of 1,000 feet seconds later, the rocket booster fell away and the 18-foot cruise missile dipped perpendicular to the water's surface as its turbofan engine fired. The Tomahawk, essentially a pilotless airplane, veered northeast, trailing white smoke in its 550-mile-per-hour flight toward the Croatian coastline. The Tomahawk's terrain-hugging object avoidance navigation was possible because of its TERCOM, terrain contour matching, and DS-MAC, digitized scene mapping correlator, aided by GPS and INS guidance systems. During terminal phase on-target approach, the Tomahawk's onboard radar homing systems would take over. 3 seconds later, a second Tomahawk launched from another VLS cell, following in the wake of the first, but taking a slightly different course, programmed to arrive at the same time. Redundancy was key for a mission as critical as this one. The only problem was, neither missile had a target. Chapter 65. Jack glanced at the GPS marker on his phone. Aida's blue arrow had stopped moving. Thanks to the Renault's thrumming V6 engine, he made much better time than she did. He was close. A few minutes later, he pulled to the side of the road where he couldn't be seen. According to the GPS map, the Volkswagen van was parked in front of a house set back from the main road. Beyond the house, toward the back of the property near a steep hill, was a newly constructed warehouse-style steel building. The whole compound was set in a clearing surrounded by trees. Jack checked for passing traffic as he slipped his phone's Bluetooth earpiece on. No vehicles were on the road, so Jack grabbed Amir's chromed pistol, jumped out of the car, and dashed for the tree line. Jack stood in the trees scanning the compound for movement, but saw none. No Aida, no Burkic, and sure as hell no rocket launcher. Only the house with Aida's van parked in front about 100 feet away, and the big steel storage shed 1,000 feet back. He figured Aida must be in the house. But was anybody in the shed? Come to think of it, that shed was big enough to hold one of the really big Happy Times tour buses, or an 18-wheeler, or a Grad rocket launcher. If he went for the shed, Aida might slip away. But if he went for Aida, he might be sentencing thousands to their deaths if the rocket launcher was located in that shed and started firing. He started to run toward the shed, but stopped, his mind racing. Something about that live video feed had been nagging at him for the last 10 minutes. He called Gavin. Jack, it's Gavin. I've patched you in on a conference call with Jerry and— Jack, it's me, President Ryan said, and a few others on VTC. What did you find? I found the van, but no Aida, no Burkic, no rockets, and no launcher. At least not yet. But I've got an idea. Gavin, do you still have the live feed on your end? Well, of course. I can see it on my end, too, the president said. That live feed, Jack said, doesn't it keep the exact same center point? Like the drone is circling around the stadium, but the center point never moves? Yeah. Looks like a pre-programmed flight pattern, Gavin said. Sure. But maybe it's not just a video feed either. What do you mean? You said that Burkic thought he had a way to make those rockets more accurate. If they were somehow laser-guided by that drone, that would do the job, wouldn't it? Dang it. Why didn't I think of that? Gavin blurted. That drone is probably shooting a laser guidance beam along with the video image. The Bosnians need to shoot that thing down, the SecDef said over Jack's phone. No, Jack said, just the opposite. That drone is a link between the stadium and the launcher. Which means I can find the launch site by tracing the launch computer uplink to the drone, or the drone's video signal. Well, unless they're encrypted. Do it, Gav. Good work, son. Gavin will take it from here, President Ryan said. Jack hung up, relieved that the launcher and rockets were taken off his plate. Now he could focus on finding Aida and Burkic and make them pay for their crimes. Jack sped over to the front of the house and climbed the porch as quietly as possible, the big chromed Colt in his hand. He listened again. Thought he heard some noise inside, but he couldn't tell what. No voices, though. If it was Aida, she was likely by herself. Jack carefully turned the unlocked door handle and gently pushed the door open, trying not to make a sound as he slipped inside. He stood in a living room. There were 2 doors on the left, both open. One was an empty bedroom with bunk beds, the other a bathroom. To his right was a staircase leading to the second story. A closed swinging door was on the wall opposite him. A kitchen, he guessed. The living room was strangely familiar. He'd seen it before in the video Gavin had pulled of Burkic. A giant black Aqab flag was nailed to a wall, and the video camera Burkic used to record himself was still on its tripod in front of the folding chair he was sitting in when he made it. The only thing that was missing was the rifle and Berkich. The noise was louder now, coming from the other side of the swinging door in front of him. Thumping, zipping,